Hey, this is Ashley.
Hey, this is Marcy.
And this is School on Life, a weekly podcast about life, love, and occasionally libations. It's hard to believe, but School on Life podcast started almost 3 years ago, and Marcy and I are so proud of the growth and development of the podcast thus far. If you're new here, or if you've been following since June 2017, we're so thrilled that you're here, and we're so grateful for the community we built at School on Life. If you haven't recently, make sure that you check out our website at School on Life Pod. That's S-C-H-O-L-I-N Life Pod. You'll see a refresh and an update that we recently did just to make sure the content is fresh. And you can see all of the episode notes from previous episodes there. Also, make sure you're following us on social. On Facebook, we're at School on Life Pod. And on Instagram, we're at School on Life Podcast. And make sure you're following and engaging with our content on social as well. We are so grateful for over 100 episodes, nearly 100,000 downloads, and 3 years of podcasting in a space that's for us, by us. Thanks for listening. So this week in Mentor Moment, I'm talking about the glass cliff. I'm sure you've heard of the idea of the glass ceiling, right? Which talks about this sort of invisible space where women and minorities can only rise to a certain level. They can see above them. They see people rising and advancing, but there is a ceiling for them. But the glass cliff is actually what happens when organizations are looking to hire minorities and women, Black women in particular, when they're in trouble. So times like right now, where organizations are really scrambling to increase the number of Black and brown people that they have as a part of their organization, when they're looking to, have more visible diversity, when they're looking to, pledge funding and support to Black and brown folks, and they're talking a lot about diversity, equity, inclusion in their organization. So they're scrambling to hire LGBTQI identified professionals, or they're scrambling to hire disabled people, or they're looking for a Black woman to change the culture of their organization in a meaningful way. And honestly, I think that that's great for Black professionals. There's so many of us who do great work and who don't receive the visibility and recognition of that great work in a meaningful way. So this reckoning that we're experiencing in our country right now, while it's a lot about defunding the police and police brutality, it can also be a lot about work and Black folks in the workspace and why that matters so much. And so what I want to sort of encourage you is that as you see these job opportunities, and they're out there in plentiful across so many industries, across the beauty industry, across the medical industry, they are out there across tech fields and higher education, and nonprofit work. So many professionals, so many organizations, institutions, and companies are looking to hire people who are knowledgeable about equity and inclusion and advocacy and justice, and are talking about their commitment to this work. But what I want you to avoid is the glass cliff. Too often, when companies are looking to change their organization, their culture in a meaningful way, when they're looking to do something that's really impactful, they will hire people of color, they will hire Black people, they will hire women to do really difficult and challenging work, which again, there's nothing wrong with that, but they won't ensure that they have the institutional support. They won't fund them. They won't pay them extra to do that this work. They won't put new positions. They won't hire a team. There will be no institutional buy-in, and they will put you in a position where you take on new roles, new responsibilities, go into an organization that is not ready for the change that you are hoping to institute. They will put you in a position where they'll, you know, build you up and tell you you can do it and that they believe in you, and then they will provide no additional support to do the work. And then you will find yourself out on a glass cliff, i.e. this sort of idea that you are just kind of out there, you know, doing this work by yourself with no support, with no institutional knowledge, with no institutional buy-in. And this is particularly true if you're coming from outside of the organization or you're going into a new or different department. You can find yourself out there on a cliff, you know, shouting to the rooftops these ideals that they espoused in a letter, in a public statement, but that they don't espouse inside of the organization. So in the video this week, I share three strategies to avoid ending up out there on this glass cliff. with and what you can do to protect yourself and to protect your reputation and the good work that we know that you can do, and making sure that you just don't end up, you know, in a situation where you can end up on a glass cliff by yourself, because we know what happens on a glass cliff. It breaks. And then they're going to fire you and say it's your fault, that you didn't drive change, that you just couldn't get the work done. And too often when this happens to Black women in particular, these roles are then filled by a white man, and there's much more institutional buy-in, there's much more institutional support, and then that person gets the recognition of, you know, cleaning house and changing the game. And so I've seen this happen too often, too much, and it's just so unfortunate. And I really just want to caution Black women in particular, but women more generally, and POCs more, even more generally, to be leery of this glass cliff. These opportunities are out there for us, and this is a good thing. I'm so excited about what it could mean for us to advance our careers in meaningful ways and all of these positions that are going to come from the movement. And I know that they will come, but make sure you're not putting yourself out there on a glass cliff. And one of the strategies that I share in the video that I'll just share a little bit more here in our conversation is that often when you're put into these positions, you're talking to the upper echelon of the organization, you're talking to director level, senior level professionals, and you're not doing the hard work of reaching down and deep down into the organization more deeply into where the people of color that you're invited to serve are. You're not talking to the mid-level managers, the entry-level professionals, the administrative staff, the cleaning staff, you know, the tech workers, the unionized employees. You're only talking, it's an echo chamber at the top. And so I really want to encourage you, if you are going into one of these really challenging positions where you're really, you know, going to be driving organizational change, that you do that through coalition building, so that if you are kind of going out on a cliff, the cliff gets extended to a mountain because there's a lot of people behind you or beneath you that are like leveraging you, that you're not just kind of hanging on by a cliff, but that you're extending that cliff into a mountain that you can really build and speak from in a meaningful way. And so definitely check out this week's video. It's at Instagram.com/AshleyAshire. That's Instagram.com/AshleyAshire. That's my personal Instagram, and that's a platform for which I speak from Mentor Me. And I want you to make sure that you check that out, because I just want you to be aware. And I want you to know what it means. And I want you to make sure that you're not setting yourself up for failure, but instead you are setting yourself up for success. So this week in I Digress, we talk self-sabotage. And it's so interesting that it goes into that same vein of like what it means to make sure that you're protecting your life and your career. We talk about the harm that we do ourselves. The same idea of self-sabotage can be said for the glass cliff. If we're not careful, if we're not leery of these opportunities that we get presented with, we can end up on a glass cliff. And it's the same for self-sabotage. Self-sabotage is something that we don't often recognize, but it can be destructive to our lives and to our work. So listen, as Marcy and I talk about how we avoid self-sabotage and get out of our own way. And we're really excited because we're going to use two of our fave self-sabotagers, Issa and Molly, and leverage this week's episode of Insecure and just really the season to talk about how we see these ladies self-sabotaging over and over. But before we start to talk about them in more detail, let's talk about what self-sabotage is. Marcy, how would you define it?
So I would generally define self-sabotage as anything that you're doing, whether willingly and knowingly or unknowingly, to take away from the joys and the benefits that you can get out of life. And a lot of times we talk about it in context of relationships, and I do think that it does show up a lot in relationships, but I also think it shows up in work. It shows up in aspiring for the future whenever you have any kind of doubt in yourself and you act from that doubt, or you act from a place of fear, you act from a place of insecurity, it leads to making decisions that do not serve you and do not suit you, and that are not in your best interest. And so I think that that is self-sabotage. What about you? How would you define self-sabotage?
I think it's both a mindset and actions. And typically to be a person who self-sabotages, on some level, you sort of know that it's destructive. but you keep engaging in the behavior because either you do find some joy from it, some fleeting joy, some fleeting pleasure, but there is some joy. And because you can't envision a forward future. You can't envision what's on the other side of self-sabotage. And so you just keep following this pattern because at least you know it, it's familiar. And for me, that's what self-sabotage is. It's like not being able to see the future in a meaningful way. And so you just stay stuck in this sort of destructive behavior because you don't know anything beyond it. And I think that, you know, for me, one of the biggest signs of like self-sabotage and self-sabotaging people is like woke people, because it's like, you know enough to like know better, but you don't really do better. Like, you know, you intellectually know what's better. You intellectually can see like, oh, I could get played in this situation, or, oh, I'm playing myself, but you are so stuck, right, in the behavior and so stuck in like not being able to see a forward future that you just keep doing the same thing. And so for me, one of the signs that you could be self-sabotaging is that you're like super woke. You just like third eye to the sky, right? That's a sign for me. I also think, like when I think about insecure and that framework that we're kind of working from today, like Issa, and it was a friend who sort of hipped me to the fact that there's a large community online who really feels like Issa is the problem because she's a user, right? Like, she literally is a user, and she only leverages her friends and people in her life when she needs something. And again, it speaks to sort of like she's gotten that feedback before, and it kind of plays over and over in her mind. And while I don't think that that's entirely true, like I'm like working to espouse some type of empathy for her, because I think moreover, she's the injured party. But I also kind of feel like she does find herself in the messiest of situations, and in. There have been opportunities for her to avoid the messy, but she leans into it. She just leans into mess. And I was proud of her, you know, in this most recent episode where she did, you know, really tell Daniel like, hey, I'm dating my ex and da 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 da. But you, and so that was good. I guess I'll give her that. But then you kind of let the day linger and you stay longer and you take them over, you know, you stay when you, you know, over your ex-friend's house or whatever and hang out, and you're setting yourself up for failure in a way that is just a repeated pattern that I think is really problematic. So like seeing this, like one being woke and sort of knowing but not doing, and then the repeated pattern is definitely for me a sign that you might be self-sabotaging. What about you, Marcy? Like, do you feel like there are signs like, oh girl, red flag, you're probably self-sabotaging?
Absolutely. And I think that it shows up in the outcomes and in the products in your life. So if you think about, particularly with Issa and Molly, like the pattern of dysfunction in their relationships, that is a huge sign of self-sabotage. Like, if you don't have any really healthy, fruitful, productive relationships in your life, you do have to kind of question what it is about you that is getting you into this, like you said, the constant like cycle of drama. So I think that's a big part. Also, like, of course, like depression and anxiety showing up and manifesting in different ways, I think can be a sign of self-sabotage. That's not necessarily always the case, but I definitely think that like you don't feel good if you're self-sabotaging. You don't feel good if you're not taking risks. You don't feel good if you're not able to live the life of joy that you want to. And like you said earlier, like there are some of those quote-unquote benefits that come from self-sabotaging, but there's an emptiness and a void there that also exists, and so that leads to mental health challenges. And so I think that that is definitely a sign that you might be self-sabotaging. And like, if you are constantly saying the same things over and over again, like if you keep repeating yourself, or if people keep giving you the same feedback over and over again and nothing is changing in your life for yourself or for the relationships that you have, that is likely a sign that you are self-sabotaging. And I think that all three of those things, honestly, even though like they're not being named in the same way, those are showing up with Molly and Issa. Like, Molly and Issa have horrid relationships with people, like absolutely horrible, and horrible relationships with each other. Like, when you think about, if we go all the way back to Lawrence, and I have to give them credit because I do feel like they are growing this season. Like, that is the thing that I have been most impressed with. But they also have some of those same patterns and behavior. So Lawrence was a long, just like, nightmare of self-sabotage, because it could have been so easy to just say, like, hey, something's not right here. We need to set a boundary about this. We need to move on. And the healing could have started a long time ago, but that didn't happen because they never communicate. Like, Issa and Molly never have a moment of actually just communicating openly and clearly until the end of the goddamn season, episode 9 of season 4. Also, just like the emptiness that they are both trying to fill, the void that they are both trying to fill from all of these other relationships and interactions is obviously there. The patterns of keep getting that same feedback and them keep saying and hearing the same things over and over again and keep going through these same cycles with people, that is also a symptom. And so I definitely see it with Issa and Molly just in general over the course of this season, and the course of all the seasons. But what about you? Like, what ways have you seen Issa and Molly's self-sabotage show up?
I think that in Molly's relationship with Andrew, definitely some self-sabotage there. I think that, and, you know, this is pot calling kettle, but I definitely sometimes struggle in my own relationship about the difference around, like, do I want to be right or do I want to be in relationship? And like, I feel so strongly, and I have very staunch views about certain things, or like feel strongly about certain things. I have certain values that are like very salient. And so, and I'm not like a pick your battles type of girl. Like, it's not that everything's a battle, but my philosophy is just like, right is right and wrong is wrong. And I'm usually right. So, you know, but that is the problem. So I think that, you know, like Molly, I have had to learn how to, like, well, I guess unlike Molly, because Molly does not compromise. And I think that that's the problem. Like, I have had to learn how to, like, be upset and like work on my de-escalation on my own, because like everything doesn't deserve a conversation or like a debate. And I think one of the things that is a self-sabotaging behavior for me, and I sort of see it in Molly, and I say was because this is something I'm working to unlearn, but like in the past, I had to talk through everything. Like, everything had to be a conversation. I had to talk through it. I had to work through it with you. I had to process it. And like, I think I'm unlearning that. And I'm more over now, like, okay, yes, you have a problem with this, but the problem is you have it. And you can either process it and work on it and figure out how you want to feel about it on your own, or you can bring it to the relationship, right? You can bring it to the conversation, but now everybody got to have a problem, like you and your partner. And do you want you and your partner to have this problem? Or do you want to just kind of work on it and figure out how you feel and maybe probably let it go, because maybe you realize over time it's not that big of a deal. And I think that Molly hasn't learned that lesson yet. Like, everything is a problem. And when everything is not a problem, she is still like a little low-key passive aggressive, like with the best basketball game or whatever. It's like, okay, yes, your brother, your boyfriend's brother is like low-key, like, he's a little, what do you call it? Like, he doesn't get it. Like, he's not really turned all the way over on the, what is racism? And, you know, he has some respectability politics. Why don't you just be nice? Is everything about race kind of vibe to him? But, you know, like, you passive aggressive being like, why don't you just go ahead with your brother? You don't got to worry about it. Like, wasn't really helpful, right? And sometimes that avoidance, right, that, like, well, I'm just not going to go. You go ahead. It's not like you think in your mind, I guess you think you're being helpful. Or you're like de-escalating, but that's not a good tactic either. And this, I'm not going to talk about the real thing that's bothering me. I'm just going to like let you deal with it or not handle it. Came up in her relationship with Issa too. You go to brunch. You're like, you know, sort of like being kind of like skirting across the issue, then you go home and you're mad and you're like, nothing got resolved. But you, girl, you didn't try to resolve it. You didn't say, hey, like, I'm so glad that we were catching up a little bit, but I do want to kind of address this thing because it is bothering me. It seemed to be bothering you more than it was bothering her. So like, you need to be accountable. And I think that that is a self-sabotaging behavior, the lack of accountability and like the not like having every, like if it's a problem for you, it's a problem for everybody. That is a behavior that shows up with Molly again and again. And I recognize it because it's a behavior that used to show up with me that I'm really working to work my way out of. So what about you? Like, do you feel like let's take Issa, for example, you feel like she self-sabotaged, you know, in this last episode or over the course of the season, and in what ways?
Yeah, I think that she did less of it in this last episode and more of it in previous episodes. Like, even when I think about her trying so hard to be okay with Condola and Lawrence, like, it is obvious that she's had feelings for him this entire time. And so I think that trying to, like, push those feelings aside and not be truthful with herself, maybe not necessarily being truthful with Lawrence about that, but really being honest with herself, I think is a form of self-sabotage. And so when it got to this place where they're like, oh, super in love and super like, oh, let's do this again, my concern is that her not being able to acknowledge how she truly feels and be open and honest about that is going to cause a problem down the line. Hopefully not. But also it is related to what happened with Molly, because the idea that like you just aren't going to talk about what happened with you all at all. Like, I agree, it was a lot more pressing on Molly. Like, Molly is the one that's in therapy all angry and self-righteous, which I'll remind me to come back to that. But so shout out to this therapist because I love her, but I'll be back in a moment. But yeah, I do feel like Issa is self-sabotaging by not talking about her true feelings and just like pushing them off to the side and pushing them down and pretending as if nothing happened and just be like, oh, we're just going to go back into this and just be like, oh, it's fine. Nothing happened. It's like, no, it's not.
So Marcy, let's break that down a little bit because, you know, so first of all, I thought this episode was really done so well. Shout out to Kerry Washington for directing. You know, we stand, we always stand. But like, let's break that down a little bit because, you know, like, you know, she's struggling. She want to call her best friend. She like want to dialogue with her. She, you know, thinks about like how the conversation will go. And then she realizes that Molly has already called her super selfish and you always want to talk about you. So in my mind, Issa went into the call, reached out, like, I'm going to do the hard work. Like, at first I was like, no, you got to call me, but I'm going to do the hard work to call, and I'm not gonna make it about me or even us. I'm just gonna try to like open it up. And for me, initially, my thought was kind of like, okay, like maybe like this is an introduction. And she even said, like, let's catch up some other, like, you know, this other time. So she was leaving it open for this conversation and this dialogue and this friendship is not over with. So in my mind, I actually didn't mind the approach because I felt like, do we have to like go into this deep? Like, yes, we know that there's a problem, but I feel like let's start off just with a, like a cute little brunch. We ain't even here all day. It ain't like we hanging out. It's just like, let's just connect. But it sounds like for you, you feel like both of them should have. And for me, like I said, I feel like Molly was the one who was so pressed about the thing. And so not saying that Issa didn't take any ownership, but I didn't mind her approach because I felt like it was a light way to reconnect rather than like dredging it out in public and, you know, in this space. But it sounds like you feel like Issa should have brought it up in that space and kind of took some ownership for the conversation.
Yeah, I really do. And I'm not saying that it was one person's responsibility over the other. I just think about like if Issa was my client, which I think is very poignant that Molly is in therapy and Issa is not. But if Issa was my client, I would be having a conversation with her about, okay, so what kept you from bringing this topic up? What kept you from talking about this with her? Because read the room, girl. Like, everyone could see that Molly was pissed off. Like, everyone could see that she was not interested and was not engaged. And so I don't understand how you could even believe that it was okay to continue and move forward in this particular conversation in this moment without addressing the elephant in the room. And so by her skirting around the elephant, trying to peek and look around the trunk and around the hooves, you have this chasm in between you all in your relationship, which was amplified as the relationship as the episode continued to go on, that it was obvious that Molly wanted to talk about it. And I am not, like, I am not in any way, shape, or form saying that Molly shouldn't have just brought it up, because me being Molly's therapist would be like, girl, why didn't you just bring it up? You're so mad. But also, like, it's a give and take in a relationship. And if Issa knew that this was something that was still bothering her, why not just bring it up and have a conversation about it? So I think both of them could have done better. They both could have just brought it up, because there's no way, I don't believe in like letting, just trying to let things fester until they work themselves out. Like, have a conversation, talk about what's going on, even in just asking the question of, hey, Molly girl, do you want to talk about this? I know that we left off on a bad note. Is it something that we can talk about to make this be better? And if not, then y'all can go on with the banter, but at least opening the space up, because to me, that wasn't a conversation about Issa. Like, that wasn't a conversation about, these are my feelings, this is how I'm hurt. It more so would have been a conversation of like, hey girl, I see that you are still upset. Can we talk about this? Can we go ahead and air out the dirty laundry so that we don't have to keep like tiptoeing around each other?
Yeah, that's real. And I think, you know, when I think about what's gained from self-sabotage, sometimes it could be peace, because there is peace and solace in your routine. And so, like, you know, Issa just trying to go back to how it was, and, you know, just trying to go back to like, oh, you know, this is my friend and this is how it works. There's peace in that. She didn't have to do the hard work of having a challenging conversation. She didn't have to confront her own issues of her best friend feeling like she a user, or if she is really a user. You know, it's this whole thing of around like, you know, hey, like, you know, there's peace. We can kind of go back to the banter, or at least ease into it. You know, still feels a little awkward, but you know, it's not that bad, not that heavy. So yeah, I think that that's gained. And I think that, and I say this like with compassion, but like, I think that there is some, like there is some safety in failure, or like some safety in not doing, not even failure, but just not doing, right? So like if you don't try, you don't lose. So you just kind of be like, oh yeah, you know, I didn't get that promotion, or I didn't get that job. Well, you ain't applied for no job. So you don't even have to like, you could like, oh, they just don't like me. No, you didn't try, right? And so like I feel like self-sabotage will have you in a loop around like never achieving your goals, never achieving your dreams, never reaching your full potential. Cause you can always just be like, you know, they don't really like me. I'm never going to get it. White supremacy, which real, but you know, like you can leverage that all day, because it's just like, cause you didn't do the work. Right. I think that there's some comfort in that. And I get it. I've used it. So I get it. Right. But there is some comfort. Do you feel like there's anything gained from self-sabotage?
Yeah, like there's a psychological term that we use called secondary gain, where we talk about the positive advantages or benefits of these behaviors that can often be considered unhealthy or problematic. And so I definitely think that there are gains from it. And similar to what you're talking about, like that is the gain of avoidance, is that if you don't do, you don't get disappointed, you don't get rejected, you don't get your feelings hurt, right? And so it's easier to stay in a place of avoidance, it's easier to stay in a place of continuing these same patterns than it is to have challenging, difficult conversations, than it is to be vulnerable, than it is to expose yourself to hearing someone say, actually, you are a user and I don't want to have a relationship with you. But I also, anyway, yes, that is the game, because I could go on this tangent for forever. But also, I forgot to mention, in terms of self-righteousness, is something that I noticed with Molly, is that she kept repeating, like, I'm always the one to lean in and do this. I'm always the one to bring it up. I'm always the one to have the conversation. And I think that there is a level of, when I think about gains, there is a level of just like, I'm this pious person who does things right all the time, and I'm always working so hard. So it's like an inflated self-esteem that comes along with self-sabotage as well, that also continues that same pattern and that same cycle. And being able to like humble yourself and move out of that, I'm always the one doing this, being the quote-unquote bigger person, I think that Molly does not have that quality, but it also, because she feels like she's doing these pious things or she's doing like the right thing, she gets rewarded for that. And I think that that's where Andrew like falls into encouraging her self-sabotage, is that he is like, oh my gosh, you're great, like you are trying, you're doing all these things, and he's just now trying to confront her in that. But again, it just feeds and strokes her egos, and so I definitely think that that is something that is gained. But also familiarity, comfort can be a form of happiness in some ways. I think people are okay with not taking the risk in some ways, right? So like if you're in a relationship that you can keep continuing to self-sabotage in and y'all are good, it's a question of why would I step out and try to do anything different? And so there is like a, I'm okay with this because I don't want to go out and take the risk, and it keeps you from having to do that. And so that's a gain, I guess, in some ways. And so I think that when people do start to recognize those patterns and behaviors in themselves and try to interrupt those behaviors, again, it goes back to being really honest with yourself, being really reflective and really thinking about like, what are these things that I'm doing and how are they serving me? So what are those gains that I'm getting? And then start to make really conscious, really difficult decisions about how to lean into the vulnerability, how to lean into the risk, how to lean into the anxiety that comes from the uncertainty of what might happen on the other side, and just do it anyway, recognizing that there is often something on the other side that is a lot more promising, a lot more beneficial, a lot more hopeful that you're afraid of experiencing because you won't let yourself come out of this self-sabotaging space. So I really try to encourage people to lean into vulnerabilities, to lean into that openness, because that is the space where opportunity exists, where opportunity lives. And you typically, generally avoid the negative consequences that will eventually come up from self-sabotaging, just like we saw with Molly and Issa. Had they just had that conversation and leaned into their vulnerability, leaned into their humility with one another at that brunch, and maybe next time y'all just don't go to brunch, like go to somebody's house, go on a hike, but anyway, lean into that, they wouldn't have had this blow up at the end of the episode. Also, friends, make sure you check who you're texting before you hit send.
Because when you try to play me, you play yourself. When you try to play me, you play yourself. So if you recognize that you're self-sabotaging, some of the ways that I think you can interrupt these behaviors is to like slow down. So one of the ways that I used to self-sabotage is that I felt like I had to like air out everything I was mad about all the time, like air out my grievances. Every time I'm mad, I gotta like talk about why I'm mad. So what I've started to do is to get quiet. When I'm mad about something, I get quiet and I reflect on why I'm mad, why I'm hurt, why my feelings hurt or whatever. And I process for a time, like, does this deserve the energy of involving other people? Or is this something that can be resolved by you decompressing, compartmentalizing, and like assessing if this matters or not? This does not mean like disregarding your feelings, but this does mean like doing the work yourself before you involve everybody in your feelings. I feel like this is very mature of me. I see Marcy nodding her head, and that is the approval and affirmation that I needed to know I am on the right track. Hello, Molly's indignation. Woo! Because like, and this is not something that I have always done. Like, this is work that I am like literally learning today, like every day. But like, I just like, I have like, it is just so much wiser to process whatever you're mad about on your own first. And now obviously if it's that egregious and it has to be addressed in the moment, then it has to be addressed in the moment. But usually it doesn't, at least not for me. And if it's that serious, after I've taken some time to like decompress, and I don't mean like hours and days, sometimes it can be just about like about 2 minutes of reflection before I like hit them back with a, and first of all, but like, you know, I just am trying to do that more and more. And I feel like it just resolves a lot of things. And so I feel like if you are someone who constantly is like falling out with yourself over your decision-making or falling out with yourself over your friends or your partner, like taking some time to even assess what you're mad about and why you feel away and all of that jazz is going to be so critically important for you for like, just not staying mad, I guess. Like, I want you to get out of that. I want you to be able to get over that. And you'll be able to do that in a more meaningful way if you can take some time to do that for yourself. And then the other thing goes back to what I said, first of all, in terms of like, what are some signs that you might be self-sabotaging? So one of the reasons why you might be self-sabotaging is because you have no vision for your future beyond where you are. Like, so like, for example, in a relationship, if you know that like this person that you're with is gonna be your husband or the father of your children or, you know, like some future state for you, then the like how you engage them currently, like you'll be able to think, be more thoughtful about how you engage them currently because you know there's a future state for this relationship and you don't want to do anything now that would impede that future state. Like, so for me, like knowing what the future can be or having a vision of what I want my future to be helps me make better decisions now. And I feel like it's the same thing with self-sabotage. Because you have no vision for your future, you have no vision for what is next for you, you're so stuck in the current and you can't get out of a self-sabotaging, self-deconstructing, self-terrible spiral, right? But if you can envision a future state where things can get better, then you can start working towards said future state. And I think that that's a really powerful way. Like, literally doing some vision exercises, literally like doing the hard work of like thinking about what your future could be like can really help you unlearn or reframe some of your behaviors today. What about you, Marcy? Like when you recognize that your clients are self-sabotaging, or like you said, you know, if I was Molly's therapist, if I was Issa's therapist, what strategies would you give them to interrupt those behaviors?
Yeah, I was nodding so hard because I remember having a conversation like very similar with a client about that, taking time to reflect and figure out, like, is that something that you need to approach this person about, or is this something that you feel like you can work through on your own? And just them being very confused about that conversation. But anyway, so no, I do think though that that is a very helpful strategy, is taking that time to pause. I also just think that, I don't know, y'all, like, I know that I probably sound like a broken record, but I really do believe that open, honest communication is the way to interrupt these behaviors. Really being, but it does take that reflection part first, right? Like, it does take getting to a skill. And like, Ashley, I think that you are at a different place mentally of being able to do that pretty quickly. There are some people who still need like a couple of hours and a couple of days, and there's no like shame in taking your time and doing that. But take the time to really sit down and get in touch with your emotions and get in touch with what you're feeling. What is this bringing up for you? Is it bringing up an insecurity that you have? Is it bringing up a previous past relationship or a trauma? Like, whatever that is, be able to recognize what it is bringing up in you that is preventing you from being able to engage authentically with whomever or whatever the situation might be. But you cannot have that open, honest communication if you haven't had that first with yourself. So be really intentional about getting to know yourself and understanding your patterns and behaviors so that you can stop making those cyclical behaviors. For example, Issa, horrible at communication typically, but she took a very courageous step to say, hey, I'm back with my ex. Like, I see. Actually, I don't know why she can read the room with Nathaniel or whatever his name is, but she can't read the room with Molly. But like, I see that you are feeling me. And so instead of me skirting around these boxes, I'm just going to tell you that I'm back to dating my ex. And I thought that that was such a beautiful moment for her. I was so proud of her because that is what it is. You know that you are used to avoiding conversations. So instead of doing your typical behavior, you chose to do something different. I think a lot of times once that awareness is raised, once that insight is gained, it's a lot easier for you to start making different decisions in relationships.
Although I will say, he's such a hating hoe. Oh, I mean, that dude's shifty though. You know what I'm saying? He seems like kind of flaky. Boy, if you don't,
Such a hater. I was just like, is this what men do? Like, y'all always talking about women being petty. That was such a petty response.
I mean, good luck with that. If you don't, we digress. Anyway, Marcy, it's time for All Black Everything. What do you have for us this week?
So this week in All Black Everything, I just want to shout out a little libation. We haven't talked about libations in a while, so I figured I would just shout out a little libation. Over the weekend, I was at a Zoom birthday party, and a fellow participant was drinking a whiskey. And y'all know I'm not a brown girl, so a brown liquor girl. So hubby got really excited about this liquor called Uncle Nearest Premium Whiskey. And as we did a little bit of research about it, Uncle Nearest is actually a black man. And he was a master distiller. His name is Nathan Nearest Green. And he basically taught Jack Daniels like how to make whiskey. And so finding out about this man, they basically took his recipe and made it a staple to create this liquor. So the company is actually like fully minority led, primarily women led. The CEO is Fawn Weaver, who is a black woman. She's the CEO and co-founder of the Uncle Nearest Premium Whiskey. There's a separate distillery of where it's made at. But it was just really interesting to see, like, black folks have such a long history in so many different areas in so many different ways. And, like, the common whiskeys, the Jack Daniels and all those other brown liquors that y'all drink, those are very common names. But Uncle Nearest is not one of them. But they are out here trying to raise that level of awareness. There was actually a short film called The Story of Nearest Green that included Emmy Award-winning Westworld actor Jeffrey Wright to narrate the film. And so, like, people are really trying to raise awareness and spread the story of Uncle Nearest, which I think is a really powerful story to share, and even just what the company is doing with it being minority-led and with it being women-led, I think is also a really amazing thing. So just wanted to share some positive libation history with y'all in the midst of all of the chaos in the world.
Because who doesn't need a drink? I'm actually drinking a Chardonnay right now. So, and actually one of our listeners and followers sent me some information about a black female owned winery. So let me see if I can find it and pull it up and I'll share it with folks. So Rose Wine Mansion did a post about 70 plus black owned wineries you can buy wine from today. And I'll be sure to share this on the School and Life podcast, Instagram in the stories so that you can check it out. But there are wineries literally from all over the country. Wineries like Ascena Wines, Longevity Wines, J. Moss Wines, Brownstone Estate, Heritage Link Brands, the House of Mandela, just like 70 plus. And so you can follow and engage with them on social media. You can buy their wine. Lots of them do ship, which is awesome. You can share info about wineries and their wineries on your IG, and then plan a trip to visit the wineries once they open. So they're all linked in this post, and I'll be sure to share it. And shout out to the McBride sisters. They do a lot of work in the winery space too. And I think they actually have their own winery. Ariana is a rosé and chambray blogger who does work around style, wine, travel, and decor. So I definitely encourage you to check them out. And like I said, I'll be sure to share their work in our stories. So shout out to black people making wine and things.
Also, to add to the Nearest Green story as well, because I thought this was really dope, like, we're still out here making history. They actually hired Green's great-great-granddaughter, Victoria Butler, to be the first family member to curate a bottle. And she had been working for the Department of Justice for 31 years, but she actually became one of the first African-American female master blenders in the U.S. because of her training in making this whiskey. So I also just wanted to shout out Black women for being so dope. In addition to wineries, we out here being master blenders as well. So yes, please support all the Black businesses for sure.
Indeed, indeed. And we're a Black business ourselves. So ways that you can support School on Life, you can share our content, you can give us a 5-star review on iTunes, you can like our content. It's so important to spread the voices of Black women and listen to Black women, and you're already doing that. So feel free to share the podcast with somebody. We're so proud of our growth, and we are, because you are sharing it. And so please continue to do that. So in TVT this week, we already talked a little bit about Insecure, but there were some other characters that popped up and stayed a while over the last couple of episodes. Marcy, I know you want to talk a little bit more about Lawrence and him being a San Francisco treat. So let's dig in. What do you want to share?
The San Francisco treat, that little exchange just cracked me up. So essentially what I wanted to talk about last week too, when Lawrence made his big debut back again, I just felt so conflicted about them getting back together. And like, I am a hopeless romantic. And so I just love love. Like, I love seeing it. And I just love like people being in love, and I love their chemistry. And so I was easily sucked back in. And then I had to remind myself of how we got here and the trash that had occurred over the course of 3 seasons prior to getting to this point. And so I just felt really conflicted. I just wanted to like have some time to process my feelings around that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, we've talked about closure on this show. We both said we're not sure if we believe in it, if it's necessary. I feel like this whole like let's get up, let's have dinner thing was not a closure conversation. This was more like a let me see what you up to and see how you doing, because I heard you and old girl broke up conversation. And I just kind of feel like, you know, I don't know, I just kind of I feel like they are falling back into some patterns and into some behaviors. I mean, I do think they had some tough conversations, and I do think they kind of did some of the work at the dinner table. And, you know, it's like one of those things, what you're supposed to do, just talk about the problems for 6 months before you kiss? I don't mean, you know, it's fine. Like, I'm not pressed about that, but I'm a little pressed about, like, I feel like Issa don't really have her life together. Does she have a job?
I think that her job is curating events in the Black community now.
Does she have a job? Did you hear me? Does she have a job? Like, is she bringing...
She is an entrepreneur, Ashley.
Did she say she made money off the block party? I see. So entrepreneur means that you make money. Not that you spend money or collect money from vendors. I'm saying, does she have a job? Like, does she make money? Because I'm trying, like, I feel like Issa's life is very unstable. So I just feel like maybe Issa should be focused on herself. Like, Lawrence is also going through a pretty heavy transition. He's not happy at work. It's time for a transition. He's looking for new jobs. Like, it's just a very tumultuous time in both of their lives. And I feel like maybe they should be focused on themselves. But, you know, call me crazy. I don't know.
That's fair. So I also noticed, and I think I just made this connection, the difference between the conversation between Lawrence and Issa and Molly, and how the conversation between Lawrence and Issa was an opportunity for them to talk about the elephant in the room and how Issa and Molly didn't do that, and the differences that showed up in the way those two relationships progressed, number one. Number two, though, I think that what I experienced between the two of them is that they have done the work separately. So they have been doing their own experience of growth and their own experience of just like change and figuring out new things for themselves, so that they were able to come back together and have this dialogue and this conversation and move forward from a different space. I do see tragedy on the horizon because...
Girl, you're trying to say, you know, I have brought a ring. That's how they always get you, want to tell you they brought a ring. What if you don't get out of my face? Playing ballhead games in my face? Ugh, disgusting.
So you clearly are not here for this, and I'm clearly
so this is the
in
thing.
Love.
I'm not here for it, because like them on that little couch, I was like, vibes, right? Like, I wasn't mad at it, I think what I'm struggling with is that, like, I feel like Issa is like, oh, I don't have Molly, let me go play with him. Or, oh, I don't have this, let me go do this. Like, it's just like, I don't, and I guess I don't know what I expect from her. Cause like, I'm an entrepreneur. I'm very supportive of the work. You gotta, you know, sometimes you gotta build, you gotta grind. Like, I just feel like there are just, I worry that she, you talk about she's done the work. And I, like, has she? She hasn't. I haven't seen her go to therapy. I haven't seen her have as many challenging conversations as she needs to have. Like, even when she was like, so yeah, what is this? And then he was like, whatever you want it to be. And she didn't articulate what she wanted. She gave him a kiss and they start having sex. Like, what? Are you doing the work? I'm not sure.
So, no, she hasn't gone to therapy. Which, you know, I'm an advocate for everyone to go to therapy, but I also believe that not everybody has to go to therapy to grow, because Lawrence ain't been in therapy either. Nathan don't sound like he's going to therapy either. Like, he has a diagnosable mental illness. So, yes, I do. Like, I am not saying that I think that Issa has grown, like, has reached self-actualization by any means, but I do think that they're in a very different place than they were. When they first got here. And I still think that it is going to end horribly. Like, either he's just going to move to San Francisco, which is a fine way of it getting resolved, or something else is going to happen. Like, I don't feel like this is just going to end on a happy ending, but I do think that they are different people than they were when they were dating the first time. And so this can be a different relationship if they continue to do work, and maybe they do go. Like, I would encourage them to go to couples counseling, you know.
Listen, I'm not mad. I wouldn't be mad at them. I wouldn't be mad at Issa if she left either. Like, I know she loves LA and it's home, but like, I think it would be cute if she just like was like, oh, I'm gonna follow you because like, this is your dream and I'm gonna support you.
See, I don't agree with that.
No, I mean, I just feel like he needs somebody in his corner. You know, Lawrence, he was mad because Kendola wasn't trying to get married, even though he wasn't trying to get married. Like, you know, he needs a cheerleader. So, you know, rah-rah, sis gonna buy, girl. You better giddy up. I don't know. I'm nervous. I feel like I really need, like, I'm worried that Andrew is, like, not gonna leave. Like he's gonna stay by Molly, and that worries me because I do feel like no one's holding her accountable. I do worry that Daniel is going to get his feelings hurt, and he's going to express his feelings, get them hurt, and that's going to cause some long-term problems for him, especially now that he's living alone and he's starting a new business venture, and that's just a lot of jet. That's a lot. I worry that Lawrence isn't going to get the support that he needs from Issa. He's always craved her approval, always craved her support, was jealous of her when she had a job and he had nowhere to go, right? Like, and if she rejects him again and it's like, oh, you got this new opportunity, but I can't support you, I think that that's going to break their relationship. And I don't, they will not be a successful long distance relationship. That will not work. And I low key, this is random and off the charts, but I low key feel like Issa's going to reconnect with her father, who we've never seen. Do we know who he is? I don't even know. Like, but I feel like she maybe has daddy issues and we're going to see him in this last episode. Any predictions for you for the future?
That is so random. But I don't know, a whole bunch of drama. Like, the preview for next week seemed like a whole bunch of mess, and Nathan does express his feelings, and then I don't know. I'm not good at predicting stuff, but we'll see. I guess we'll see very soon what happens. But also, one last thing. This therapist is going to get Molly all the way together. When I tell y'all that this is the first, or maybe not the first, but one of the few portrayals of a Black therapist that is actually like, yes, this is how I would be talking to my client. I was so grateful for this depiction, this portrayal, like holding her accountable, pointing out her patterns, challenging her, confronting her. I was just like, yes. Thank you. So I appreciate Insecure for handling mental health issues appropriately for Black folks, for sure.
Yes, and shout out to Black female therapists. I have a Black female therapist, and she, I don't know if she ever gathered me quite like that, but you know, she has challenged me in ways that I felt have been meaningful, and she always give me homework. You know, I stand on assignment, so definitely doing the work. And so shout out to them. And that wraps up this week's episode of School and Life. Thank you so much for listening. We're so grateful for your listens, for your community, just for engaging with us each week. If there are ways that we can serve you better, make sure you let us know. You can hit us up at hello@schoolandlifepod.com in our email. That's hello@schoolandlifepod.com. Thanks so much for listening. We'll see you next week. School's out. Class dismissed.